This podcast contains strong language and adult themes from the outset. This week, we are absolutely delighted to welcome a British pop icon onto Finding the Funny. This lad from Stoke rocked up to an open audition for a new boy band, and the rest is history. He saw ever-growing success between the 90s, 1990 to 95, to be precise, in the boy band that we loved in our household called Take That. They were a new era of boy bands. From hits like Never Forget through to the track he took lead vocals on called Everything Changes, Take That were adored by millions worldwide. Their success grew and grew. In 95, this lad from Stoke chose to leave boy band life behind and go it solo. He released his first solo single, Freedom, a cover of George Michael, and what followed was outstanding global success. Did you know he's won a record 18 Brit Awards? He's been dubbed the greatest artist of the 90s and has sold a whopping 75 million records worldwide, making one of the best-selling artists of all time. His song Angels is adored by myself and loads of people all over the world. It's truly iconic. Life hasn't been plain sailing though, and this guest has been honest about his struggles with mental health and addiction. He's currently on a new European tour, which having seen it, I can say is absolutely outstanding. We are totally amazed that he's agreed to come on and chat to us, so please give it up for the iconic, the amazing, the super talented Mr. Robert Williams.
Woo! That, I think that's the longest intro we've ever had.
Yeah, what an intro that is.
What a life you've had.
Far be it from me to correct such a wonderful intro, I feel, you know, I have correct. To say, because of the ego and the self-loathing will not allow me to remain erroneous.
Okay. Oh,
but no. It's 86 million albums and over 100 million records.
Pats, what the you have knocked that right
not, up. Not I mean, like, is there a difference between 70 million records and 100 million
not
records?
Really.
Is it
not really?
Not really. No. Where is it that it starts to like meet? Is it like after 5 million,
so.
1
yeah.
million?
I think then they just roll into one, really, don't they?
20,000.
I mean, basically what we're saying here, Rob, is that Patty just fucked that. And also I call her Patty.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're aware of
that. Oh, right, okay. Yeah. No, she didn't fuck it at all. It's quite quite astounding.
It is.
You know, reliving my... And I always think that my lead vocal on Could It Be Magic was better than Everything Changes.
Oh, that is a classic, isn't it?
Yeah, and I'm always embarrassed that Freedom was my first single because...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I made a big stink about wanting to go and write my own songs. And then the first thing that I did was release a cover. It still
pains
irks
you,
me.
Doesn't it, Rob?
Yeah, I mean, it's not painful as it was, but it's irksome. Mm. On a level of irk, I think it's a 4.5.
Right. Is that out of 10? Is that what you do your irks out of? Out of 10?
Yeah.
4.5
yeah.
irks
yeah,
out
yeah.
of 10.
Yeah, 4.5 irks out of 10. Yeah, I think that it used to be an 8.5.
Oh, if it's gone down. It's halved.
I think your irks decrease as you age and mature.
I agree, Rob. I absolutely agree.
I've got a question actually about the early days, which I only found this out relatively recently from an interview I watched you do with Zane Lowe. Did you write Life Through a Lens in 12 days?
Yeah, maybe less.
Wow.
Actually.
You wrote that whole album in 12 days.
Yeah, there was so much waiting to come out.
Wow.
And I needed somebody with, I don't know, I'd got the key and I needed somebody with a door. Mm. And that door was owned by Guy Chambers. And we got together and Bish Bash Bosh, first album done, probably in less than 12 days, actually.
Bloody hell. Off the back of that, when you wrote Angels, when you wrote that song, did you have any idea the gold that would become?
No, you can't. There's no way that you could expect it to become what it's become. But I knew there was something very special. I didn't know what it meant, but when it was finished and formulated and demo version at Guy Chambers' flat, he became so tired and almost ill that he had to take himself to bed. And I just remember staring at the tape because it was on, you know, this demo was on a cassette. And I can just remember staring at the tape in a daze. And maybe he got so tired from a download that happened. And I've never had that feeling again, to be honest with you. You know, like I've probably written close to 1,000 songs.
Wow.
And I've done some decent stuff, but I've never managed to achieve something, you know, that kind of lightning in a bottle. I've never managed to achieve it again. So something very special happened that day, and we both definitely felt it. Mm. But there was a million miles between my solo career becoming a success and having something special that I was in a daze with on a cassette. So, a day.
I mean, that, like, it's remarkable to, because that album, like, for anyone that doesn't know, I've been a fan of Robbie my whole life, probably. And I remember that, I distinctly remember James and I loved Take That, loved You.
Not me so much, Rob, debate, to be honest.
It's fine. I've always been a massive fan of you, but...
Well, you know.
Let me tell you something. Mm. Let me tell you something that James doesn't believe, but it's true.
Right, okay.
Your brother came to see me in Watford.
Yeah.
And I remember him.
Watford Coliseum. No. I remember him going to that gig.
I remember him from the gig. And I tell you for why. So as a, you know, being in Take That, we were doing arenas and it was 12,000 screaming girls.
Yes.
Not one fella's face in the place, you know. And I remember being at Watford Coliseum and seeing my first
boy
or man in the audience.
Wow.
And I thought he was there to take the piss. Right? And I can remember this clear as day. I locked eyes on your brother. This is years before I knew him. I locked eyes on your brother and your brother looked up at me and he went like that and he winked.
As you do.
And I thought, you bastard, you've paid money to come here and mock me.
When actually,
genuinely,
he was like just completely and utterly in love with you.
Super fan.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thinking. Listen, let's not meander into a very serious conversation after I say this. But thinking that everybody hates me has been something that has been with me for a long, long time.
Mm.
I'm releasing that more and more at the tender age of 48. Mm. But it was very palpable in that moment with your brother. How that mental is that?
That is so crazy.
And you know, I told your brother that and he didn't believe me, but it's God's honest truth.
That is mental. That is like chicken oriental. Now we've had some questions in from our listeners, Rob, all
who were all ecstatic that you were
this
coming.
This is actually,
on.
You know, all great. 10 of them have actually put in a question.
They should just be on this Zoom this
should.
Call
they
now.
Could they should have joined, have, couldn't they? Yeah, they could have asked you live. So we'll just rattle through a few of these questions. This is a question that came in from Isabel on Gram, and she says, how do you spend the last 5 minutes before you go on stage?
Hmm.
What do you do?
So I have a huddle with everybody that's available backstage. Mm-hmm. I try to say some wise words or try to say some empathic words. Sometimes I achieve that, sometimes I don't. I then pray to Elvis, and we all do.
Nice.
Which is kind of like serious, but a joke. Mm-hmm. And then I grapple with my intense fear and insecurities. And I somehow manage to rise above them and convince myself sometimes that I'm Zeus. And this can last almost nearly a second.
Oh my gosh.
And then I'm off into the breach. And I figured out that, you know, that there is a massive fear of performance. And I figured out what it is. It's not that I think the show's going to go badly or people are not going to enjoy themselves. It's the terror of the amount of energy that I'm about to exert.
Really?
Wow. You know, that's wow. I figured it out. That's what it is. It's like, you know, it's what I need to do is to be as fit as somebody that takes part in a decathlon.
Holy
and
shit.
I never am and I never will be, but I know what I'm expecting myself and my body to do. And even if it's not through physical exertion, it's through mental exertion, yeah. Concentrating.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's sort of like, you know, goalkeepers when they play football.
Yeah.
They're not running about. But the next day, they're on a sofa recuperating because of the amount of concentration and the levels that is taken to facilitate the performance. So I also, back in the day, with this fight or flight thing, was telling myself, you're in danger, run away. You're going to die, so run off.
Oh, my gosh.
And through, yeah, I mean, that's not consciously what the words say. It's just a feeling in your body.
Yeah.
And then what happens after a matter of time, you realize that you've heard yourself say that before and it didn't happen.
Mm.
And you understand, well, I do, that I'm more courageous than I am fearful. And I think as humans, we all are. I think we're all more courageous than we give ourselves credit for.
Mm.
And we don't know that because the fight or flight feeling is so palpable and strong, you know, that we tend to believe our emotions.
Have you always felt that, Rob? Have you always had that, like, fight or flight, like, fear of that? Going out on stage and actually, do you know what? I just need to get away. I need. Has that always been how you have been before you perform?
Yeah, I played the Artful Dodger when I was 12, 13 in a local play, and definitely like the role of a lifetime, perfect for me. And subsequently playing this role, I got a standing ovation, and it was the first time that I went, oh, I can do a something. I'm worthy of applause. Mm. Wow. Mm. Let's see where this takes us. But I very much remember standing in the wings, being overwhelmed with paralyzing fear.
Really?
And, you know, it remains.
Do you know, I think what you've encapsulated there is totally fascinating, because everybody has their going on stage moment, don't they? It might not be as big as going out to perform to the O2 or in Hamburg or at the Albert Hall or whatever, but what you're saying is in our own lives, whatever your going on stage is, your ability to be courageous is much greater than your ability to be fearful. And for everybody for all the 10 people that listen to this, we might get 12 as you're on, Rob.
Yeah,
we might really hit dizzy heights. But for everybody that listens to this, I think, because it's so easy, I think, for us to go, oh, but I'm never going out on stage at the Royal Albert Hall. But that doesn't matter, does it? What you're saying is that those things that come up in our lives that feel terrifying, the golden ticket is to remember you've got more courage than fear.
Well, I also think that you can sort of take that, like, in its essence, that can be a social gathering or it can be a dinner party or it can be a visit to the pub or a day at the races or it can be, you know, a family gathering, or it can be wherever or whatever it is where you feel discombobulated and you feel discomfort. And I think, you know, forget about the O2. Most of life is spent being uncomfortable. So, yeah, you can apply it. The problem is believing it, because the emotion is so overwhelming that you can't talk sense to it because it's in charge.
Oh, God, what I mean, from a question about what you do before you go on stage, Rob, that is, I know that will be so helpful to so many.
It's helpful
people.
To me.
Thank you.
It's helpful to me.
And to me, absolutely.
Hugely.
To me. Yeah.
I am the world's worst for that. Like, you know, complete self-doubt, self like, oh my God, I can't do it.
Yeah, but have you ever met anybody that you like that isn't?
Wow, a good great question. Point. No, good actually. Point. Yeah, good point.
That is so true.
I don't like anybody that doesn't feel this way.
I don't
understand them.
No.
Yeah. And you know, they say that, you know, you are oversensitive. Well, we're not oversensitive. You're numb.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, Rob.
Do you know what? What an amazing way of looking at that.
Well, yeah, you know, it's just because I you know, it's like I really struggle with people that have no empathy. That think that because in their self-righteous indignation about how people should behave and how people should feel should be exactly like them, you know, and just because you're a sociopath doesn't mean I get to be a sociopath.
Yes.
And also, look, you didn't lose your mind. It was yours to give away.
Absolutely.
I mean, what a great lyric.
Yeah.
My best one.
I would say that is probably one of your best lyrics.
Yeah.
I didn't lose my mind. It was mine to give away.
Yeah. That was a goodie.
Right. To change tact completely, every single person on Instagram that sent us a message pretty much said, will there ever be another Take That reunion with all five of you?
I guess so. You know.
What?
I like to think there will
be. Yes, Rob.
Yeah, but you know, I've got so many plans that I need to see the end of, and I can't see it being in the next 5 years.
Really?
But who knows? Who knows what happens?
We've got to drill this down.
You know, look, being in Take That is more fun than being Robbie Williams' solo artist.
Yeah.
But my ego dictates that I have to be in charge of absolutely everything.
So maybe we need to deal with that a little bit.
I also, having four children has made me sharpen my concentration in other venues and other areas of creativity and business. You know, my lineage is cannon fodder during wars. And my lineage is people that dug canals and trod bogs for people over them. You know, my grandma's school report that I've got framed says, will work well for the people over her. That was one person ago.
Yeah.
You know, there was no options. There was no chance to be a different person living a different life, experiencing different things. You were told and you behaved and you did. Now, I've managed to break the chains of the whole lineage of the Farrell DNA and the Williams DNA. And I want to be able to give that gift to a few more generations of Williamses. You know, I enjoy the thinking about how I'm going to make that happen and the employment of how, you know, my creativity is going to make that become a reality.
Yeah.
Wow.
That.
And do you have things like, if you're saying like 5 years is the kind of, you know, we're not going to be getting to that sort of Take That reunion of all five of you for at least 5 years. Have you got things in place that you know you're going to want to do in this next 5 years? Have you already got that plan?
Absolutely. I always have. You know, yeah, unfortunately, my whole life is spent in the future.
Not in the now, Rob. You know, not in the now.
Neither are you, Ange.
Oh, I'm always in the now, Rob.
There's no way. There is no way anybody on this call is in the now.
I am now because I actually put a bit of red lippy on for you.
Oh, right. Oh, okay.
So, you know, I was like, do you know what? I'm going to embrace. Usually I look like dog shit when I come on these things.
Well, you look very beautiful. You're very pretty. Although,
I mean, I look slightly less dog shit.
Before we move on from Ange, Rob, I want to ask you a question about Ange. Who do you think? So obviously my favourite member of Take That was you, and you know that that's true. That isn't me just blowing smoke up your ass. I adored you my whole life.
Jason Orange.
No. No.
No.
Gary Barlow.
No.
Mark Owen.
No.
Howard Donald.
Howard was obsessed with Howard Donald.
I had pictures of Howard on my bedroom wall.
Well, I do have to say that if I was a lady, then I would probably be obsessed with Jason and or Howard.
Yeah. I mean, Howard. Yeah. Not, you know, I mean, he's just that body, man.
Chiseled.
Oh, good Lord. The hair, the tousled hair, the sweat.
Absolutely, absolutely chiseled. I mean, and the jawline and the lithe capabilities and his beautiful way of being when he danced.
Right, you need to stop now, Rob, because yeah, I'm gonna take myself somewhere else.
Yeah, no, I totally yeah. get it.
Howard
you know?
Was my man.
And there's, you know, yeah, I understand that. There is a huge animal magnetism that Jason Orange has.
Really?
Jason Orange has. Oh,
is
yeah.
there?
Unbelievable. It's like he's doing some voodoo shit. And you're like, stop it. Stop what? I don't know what it is, but stop
really?
It.
Is he that sort of magnetic?
Yeah. Yeah, because he just does this thing, and you're like under his spell and under his power. You watch, if you ever meet him, it's palpable. It's very.
I think, Rob, we probably need to make this happen. I think we need to make this happen, that we can kind of feel magnetic drive pull.
You and me both. You know, it's like I would love a chance to experience that again with Jason.
We had a question from Tori on the gram. This question is really simple. Have you still got the pants?
I haven't got them on right now.
What pants have you on now? Let's just have a bit of a pen.
Do you know what? They're so fancy.
Right, let's see the pants. Holy sh! I mean, do you want to just pull the trousers down a little bit more, Rob?
Is your favourite film Magic Mike?
Maybe. Yes. Yeah. You know, who doesn't love a bit of Channing?
So I have celebrity dreams every night, right? Every night without fail, I dream of celebrities. And the other night I had a dream that I met Jack Grealish, and above his jeans was wearing these underpants, the same ones that I've got on. And I wanted to show him that we both wear the same underpants, but I looked and I'd got my cheap ones on from Marks and Spencer's.
And you're like, shit.
True story, true dream.
I mean, Jack, he's...
Have you still got them, though? Have you still got the pants?
I don't know if I've got the pants, but the whatever you need to help yourself get through public speaking and public performance, I'll take.
Sure.
And I have a plethora of tiger pants that are backstage that help me to, you know, get into battle. It's my armour.
I'll never forget watching that video for the first time and just being totally mesmerised. Like, I watched it so many times and I just remember thinking, do you know what? I watched that video and I said to myself, one day I'm going to meet him.
Wow.
Manifest. Put that out into the universe, Pat, and look what's happened.
Yeah. That's it.
Okay, right. One last question for Rob here. This came through from Mel on the gram. What's your favourite story that you've heard about yourself that definitely isn't true?
What's my favourite? Oh, yeah, I thought, because what is my favourite story? Oh, yeah, I know what it is. So Robbie Williams was in a bar fight in, is either Saint-Tropez or Monaco, right? And Robbie Williams beat five people up, right? Now, as it happens, the only thing that was remotely Robbie Williams was it was a man who had a car with a number plate that said Robbie on it.
Oh, my gosh.
So that is hilarious.
I think that's the one that I like being out there, or I liked at the time. Yeah,
that is brilliant. But
I actually do just want to really quickly ask one question because it's quite pertinent for this time, because the program is currently on. If you could go into the jungle with five campmates, Who would you go with?
That's too difficult. Well, I would take...
Me and Ange, obviously, first of all.
Yeah.
Us two. So you've only got three
left.
Okay. No, well, I'd take Ant and Dec.
Great. Yes. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. I would take Paddy McGuinness.
Nice.
John Bishop.
Yeah.
And David Seaman.
David Seaman. Wow, that's a random David Seaman.
Yeah, because
so you can play football and shit.
No. The best bits of Soccer Aid are the bally laughter that has happened, and the bally laughter has been elicited by John Bishop and Paddy McGuinness.
Oh, that's
and,
cool.
The kindest man and the person that you feel the safest with is Dave Seaman.
Oh, that's so lovely.
You know, and he's like the most capable person, or you feel like he's the most capable person because he's the most relaxed. So, yeah, I would go with people that make me laugh and people I feel safe.
That is a very good five you've picked there, Rob. Very good.
Thank you.
Now, Rob, we have a segment on this show called What's Getting On My Shitting Tits, where we essentially rant about something that annoys us. And we would love you to tell us what is currently or historically has been or is getting on your shitting tits.
This is quite specific and it's quite niche.
Okay.
And I've noticed that I become unnaturally angry and it's outside of my normal character. And it's weird. But things in the middle of tables piss me off.
That is such a good one, and I totally get what you're on about.
Yeah, look, you know, it's like I don't want to talk to that.
Yeah.
I find social interaction hard enough.
Yeah.
But not being unable to see somebody's mouth really pisses me off, and like my hearing is not too good, so I at least need to see that blah 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 blah.
See the lips.
So I can see the lips, and I find it so frustrating.
It's so true, Rob. I'm with you, mate.
Yeah, and it makes me like I it happened the other day, and it happens in the house.
Oh, does it?
Yeah, it happens in my house.
Oh God, no! You need
and
to there, stop that.
There was a Halloween. There was some Halloween decorations,
Halloween shit.
And it was we've got a round table in the kitchen, and there was this Halloween decoration. It's like this is all I could see of my wife, and this is all I could see of my 10-year-old Teddy, and this is all I could see of the 2-year-old, and like. The first day that it happened, I went and I picked it up and moved it into another room.
Good.
And then the next night I came back and it was back.
On the jeffing table. Yeah.
Yeah.
On the jeffing table. But it's the same if you know,
so
go to a dinner party or a restaurant or a whatever.
Also, why do they feel when you go to a restaurant, right, and you go to, you know, you're sat down, why do they feel they have to put so much shit on there? You've got like three glasses,
because
54 cutlery.
It's interior design gone mad, and it's a preference for aesthetics over functionality.
Yes, Rob.
And I'm all above the functionality. Like my wife is in charge of the interiors of the house,
right.
And you know a lot of our furniture looks absolutely amazing. Is it comfortable? Is it fuck? That annoys me too. That annoys me. It's just like. I want to sit in a cloud.
Yeah.
I want to sit in a cloud. I don't care if it comes from IKEA. I don't care if it comes from China.
Yeah.
I don't care if it's a Lazy Boy. I just want to sit in the cloud and watch TV.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't want to sit on some Swedish thing doing this.
You don't want to be upright, do you? You want to be relaxed.
No.
Yeah.
No. You know, and also if you know, if I'm lying back on something, I don't want my legs to be
right up above your head.
Like this is how much leg space my fingers got, and it's like, what am I going to do with these? There's at least 2 stone that's unmanageable.
Yeah.
Do you know what? Also,
on this
you've got to keep your legs above your head, and that's not comfortable.
Also, on the
no, I feel the same sort of level of annoyed about the things in the middle of tables as I do with the furniture in our house.
Also, just on the on the furniture front, cushions, they get on my tits.
Oh God,
too many
cushioning fucking everything. Cushions on your sofa, cushions on your bed,
and also a majority of them are complete shit.
Yeah,
complete.
Like
shit.
the one that you do this with.
Put your head on.
Rubbish.
Yeah.
Rubbish, and oh.
You have to fold. Yeah. Those ones that are so thin, you've got to fold it over a million times.
Yeah. And
cushions have gone mad.
Yeah,
right,
cushions.
There. Cushions have
cushions,
gone.
Yeah. Cushions have gone mad.
Throws.
And it's
throws.
The,
people are throwing
I think
everything.
It's this. I think it's the same people that are in charge with decorations in the middle of the tables that are in charge of the pillars.
They're all
in the same group of dicks.
Yeah.
Group of dicks.
High-fiving themselves at secret meetings.
Yeah, look at that table. Woo! Yeah, fuck off. Yeah.
Yeah, we're all telling them to fuck off secretly under our breath. That is those both.
That
of those
is so funny, Rob.
Exquisite things in the middle of the table when you can't see the person opposite you. That is annoying.
It really is.
Yeah, that's a good shitting tits. That I can't believe
you. I know. As soon as you said it, I was like, "That is fucking great." That I'm annoyed at.
Now look, Rob. We won't keep you much longer because we know that you're about to play tonight. Where are you,
Hamburg?
I'm not about to play. You've got me for as long as you want.
Oh, we were like thinking we don't want to, we don't want to like keep him.
No,
so you're not
no.
not on tonight. Where do you go next?
No, please impose because I'm enjoying myself.
Yes, we are too. Where do you go next after Hamburg?
I did this show the other night and it was unbelievable. There's this building in Hamburg that they've spent €1 billion on.
Whoa.
And I played a gig and the gig had an 80-piece orchestra. And I did it in this venue with the best acoustics in the world. Not that it matters because I had my in-ears in, so I only hear what I hear. It's like everybody the day before, I was doing like 10 interviews to 15 interviews. It's got the best acoustics in the world. I don't give a shit. I don't care. But apparently it had. But it was live streamed on Deutsche Telekom's Magenta TV and to you know, Germany and Australia and Switzerland, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
And I got to do the gig of my lifetime because I managed to do, basically, I only did 17 songs, but I did, I would say, 20 to 25 minutes worth of talking.
Wow.
And it was, you know, I would say 80% of it was all off the cuff. And I managed to express myself in a way that I've always wanted to express myself on stage. And the audience greeted it with kindness and love. And that mixed with the incredible talent that was sat behind me facilitating, making, I say facilitating a lot, I know, but like making my songs sound so angelic. Aww. It was so special.
Oh, that was so do you think that's the most special gig you've ever played, Rob?
Yeah, probably, yeah. Yeah. I tell you what depression looks like, right? Mm. Depression looks like me on stage at Nebworth.
Wow. Really?
That's what manic depression looks like. That's how well people can mask it. I tell you what depression looks like. Depression looks like me on stage at the Albert Hall doing the swing gig. Manic depression.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That is...
So these, the most pivotal moments in my career, I wasn't well. Mm-hmm. And now, because of my children and my wife and responsibility and purpose and all of that stuff, you know, I get to be there for these shows that I'm doing these days. And I'm very grateful. I'm very grateful that I have the job that I have. I'm also grateful that the audience is there. You know, I'm very, you know, there's, I realize that, you know, how fragile we are as humans and the things that protect us. I never realized that my audience protects me. You know,
it's interesting you say that, you know, because having seen this most recent tour, which if people haven't seen it, honestly, I've seen you play a number of times, right? And you were amazing. Like, I was absolutely stunned at the energy, at the way that you crafted it. And I think what was really, really apparent to me was how grateful you were to those people. And there was a beautiful moment at the one that I was at where you picked a woman out of the audience called Sue. Sue's actually messaged me on Instagram and said it was the best moment of her life. And you sang She's the One. And you said to her, Sue, you pointed to her and you said, you come to my gigs a lot, don't you? And you could tell none of it was set up, the look on her face. Yeah. And you said to her, I've looked out at your warm face multiple times at my gigs and I'm so grateful. And it makes me feel better when you're here. And I'm going to dedicate this song to you. Aww. And I just, what was so apparent was how grateful you feel. You know, there were people that were messaging on me on Instagram when I said you were coming on that were saying things like, I've grown up with him. People really feel like they fancied you in their, you know, early 20s and they fancy you just as much in their 40s. I mean, I am one of those people. I am one of those people.
Well, bless you for saying, you know, like there's that moment before She's the One where I pick somebody out in the audience. Yeah. And I would say for a couple of songs before I sing that song, I'm thinking about, you know, the fan of the night. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking who that is. And, you know, there is a huge safety when you're on stage and you're sort of scanning the audience and you're doing your performance and you're entertaining and you just sort of catch the eye of somebody that's actually in the moment beaming such love and admiration and enjoyment that it also protects you while you're on stage. And in those moments, I'm like, that's her or that's him. You know, it's like, oh, whoever that person is, they need to be told. Because it's a new thing as well with this tour, where I'm actually actively looking for the best audience member of the night.
Oh, that's so lovely. You know?
Yeah, it is.
And does it make it feel far more personal and intimate because you are kind of really looking at people and
no, I tell you what it is, because I didn't respect me or have any self-worth. My relationship between me and the audience has been tenuous. You know, it's like, if I don't like me, I was suspicious of them. So if I don't like me, why are you turning up? And you know, I think that COVID and that break has given me a different understanding of what and who they are, what they've done for me, and the protection that they have given me. Choking up.
Oh, Rob.
It's just Jesus. Oh, it's been I tell you that the thing that I hate when I'm on stage is the feeling that it won't sound authentic or sincere. Because for whatever reason, for being tired, I'm not in that moment and my emotions aren't matching my words. I love it when I get to say what I mean, but it also matches my emotion inside. And because, you know, I dislike people talking about their fans, my fans, you know, I'd like to thank the fans. I always feel as though it sounds disingenuous and insincere. And I also have noticed, especially on this tour, I come off stage, I'm so overwhelmed with how I've been greeted. I'm going again.
Sorry. This is the moment when wish we were actually in a room and I could give you a big hug.
Hold on. So and I realized that I'm putting up Instagram posts and it's picture of the evening and it says I love you. And You know, it's like I'm realizing that I'm saying it everywhere I go. Mm. I'm also realizing that I'm partial to most of the world. You know, I'm like,
oh, a great life.
Yeah, I you know, it's like I'm in Germany and I got greeted like a hero. Oh. And you know, it's that it's like, yeah, I love you too. Same in Australia, same in Austria, same in Glasgow, same in Ireland, same like everywhere I go. And it's like I'm you know, and it's that, you know, that disingenuous stuff that it seems like you guys are the best, you rock, you know.
Yeah.
It's like I don't want it to feel that way, you know, because that's not what it is. I'm a different person in a different place. And yeah, I'm very grateful.
I just wanted to just really quickly ask, while we're like talking on this subject, and if you don't want to talk about it, tell me to fuck off. But Guy Chambers, obviously there was a period in the middle where you and Guy weren't writing together. What has it been like to have Guy back?
Guy Chambers is an eccentric professor. Yeah. You know, and you know, me and Guy have been working together again for over 11 years.
Yeah.
What's it like to have Guy back? Well, he is a member of my family in the same way that members of my family are members of my mm-hmm. family. Mm-hmm. You know, and I am the, I don't know, he's the sort of, you know, he's a genius, and he's a funny fucker. He's just a funny fucker.
You can't, you know, beat a funny
it's
fucker.
Like, no, you can't. You know, it's like the reason why I'm not wired up right is a different reason why he's not wired up right.
Wow.
But he has no clue that he's not wired up right.
I reckon that's the best place to be.
Yeah. Oh, you know, it's
ignorance is bliss.
If
right?
you're wired up wrong and you don't fucking know it, well,
you don't know it.
You know, yeah. You like if you said to me you're wired up wrong, I go, yeah, and I know exactly why. If you said to Guy Chambers you're wired up wrong, he'd go, what do you mean?
One thing I was just going to ask Rob, because you sort of touched on it a few conversations ago, it was just around your kind of mental health and how you've obviously had kind of real times of real shit, basically.
Can I just tell you something?
What?
So my hair's getting thin, right?
Yeah.
And I've been spraying this stuff into my head. And it's supposed to regrow and your hair.
Right.
So, and as you can tell, I'm an emotional person. And there's like, I went back into a deep depression, right?
Did you?
10 days of deep depression. And I'm like, what the, like it felt like the 90s. I'm like, what the hell is going on? And I did this gig second night at the Albert Hall, where I could not control how emotional I was.
No.
And I just started to sob. And I was just like, oh, listen, you know, it was genuine, but it went down so well because, you know, that kind of vulnerability, that kind of vulnerability in front
people,
you know, it's like, it's not a manipulation. Mm. It's just like, I was sobbing. Wow. People are responding to this. What I didn't realize, the thing that I'd been spraying into my head before the show was actually the thing that was making me depressed.
No.
So I was vulnerable, but like maybe I wouldn't have cried that much on stage if I hadn't been spraying myself with depression.
Can of depression.
So a can of depression. Have you got any more of that depression?
It's really working for the crowds.
It's really,
They're loving it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like the actor's equivalent of the onion for when they need to cry.
That is very good.
How do you manage
that was
it now?
That was kind of like, you know, what do you do, or how do you manage that part of your life that has obviously been very difficult at times?
Well, you know, I'm not depressed anymore. But I take medication to not be depressed, so I'm not.
Yeah.
But also, there has been times in my life where I've been on that medication and I've still been a basket case. Mm-hmm. I say in the show, the thing that I was running away from, I should have been running towards, which is responsibility, you know, and I should have been running towards my Ida and getting married quicker, having children quicker, you know, that's... because of the purpose that they've given me and the way that the universe has worked for me is that I didn't have, you know, like my purpose was fulfilling my, I'll say this, it's a negative, but I'm sure there's better words, my selfish needs, my needs to be, to find some self-worth in performance. Now, if I'd have been good at maths, I'd have been a mathematician. That's where I would have got my self-worth from. The thing that I'm good at is showing off. So, you know, my performance is there. But in and of itself, fame, success, and money made me the opposite of happy. And that's quite a stark place. And a very uncomfortable realization that you get to the top of the mountain and actually I was worse than I was in the first place. It's not until the kids arrived and, you know, 17 years of being with my missus that I realize my purpose on the planet. And yeah, it makes everything make sense. Yeah, I would say... definitely in the last 5 or 6 years, my life has been tremendously different than what it was before when, you know, you're not allowed to say in my profession, work or job, because there's people that go to work and they have a job and they look at what I do and they go, that isn't it. But I have to. I have to for my sanity. You know, it's like I don't have the luxury of being able to look at what I do as a gift because I know it hasn't been. But, you know, so daddy goes to work. And because I know that and understand that, that's made a huge difference to my well-being.
Do you know, it's interesting because I think probably this tour, when I watched it, that it, I think that comes across. I think you saying manic depression is Nebworth and what manic depression looks like is me doing the swing stuff at the Albert Hall. I don't think I've ever, that, you know, you have clearly defined your life before and after, haven't you? That's what you're saying. You're saying this was me before and then there was a stake put in the ground and my life changed and the universe gave me what I needed and this is my life after. And actually you've been able to say I have my life with my family and I go to work and I do a job and you count yourself, I'm sure, incredibly fortunate to do the job that you do, but it is your job and it's a hard job. And whether or not anybody else is saying halfway down the road, well, he doesn't work as hard as I do is irrelevant because it's your job and you work really hard at it. So I think that's probably what was apparent when I watched you recently at the O2, that your contentment is greater now than probably it's ever been.
Well, to love and appreciate the job that I've got.
Yeah.
You know, it's wonderful. Yeah. You know, it's odd and it's surreal and it can be spiritual and it can be an out of body experience and it's fascinating and it's a place where you really have to wrestle with yourself an awful lot of the time. And, you know, it's the ability to be able to take in that love, which, you know, I'm not amazing at, but I'm getting better at it. Yeah, it's all of these things and it's the overwhelming urge to self-lacerate and the overwhelming urge to not trust it and not like and not love yourself isn't driving the car anymore. You know, it's in the back seat, it's still in the car, but there's somebody else in charge of the wheel now. And, you know, there has been, I'm on my way to being the kind of performer that I've always dreamt that I could be and hope to be.
That's pretty amazing.
Just quickly on the medication thing, I think I'm so pleased you raised that because I think there is still, even today, such a stigma around people who go, for my emotional and my mental well-being, do you know what, I have to take tablets. Mm. And it's so interesting, isn't it? Because if you had a heart defect or you went to the doctors and they said, Rob, you've got serious tonsillitis, blast it with these tablets, you'd go, of course, Mr. GP, I'll do whatever you tell me. But when people say, I feel like I've got to take medication to keep myself balance, there is still a scoffing, I think. So how do you feel your medication has helped you?
Well, look, I can only talk from my, from me, for in this person. Absolutely. I'm not recommending anybody to do what
Same.
I do.
Yeah.
It's what has worked for me. But also, I'm the kind of person that wants to take shortcuts. So, right. You know, I've got many ways of viewing this dichotomy. Mm. Because I just, for me, I feel like this works.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, and I've been on them a long time. And if I'm missing something, I don't know what it is.
Mm.
You know, if I'm missing a feeling or extra bandwidth,
mm-hmm.
I think that it's very dangerous to try and persuade somebody to not.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the best thing to do, if in doubt, is put the speed bumps outside of the school.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, it's like, I'm just putting the speed bumps in.
Yeah.
You know, but I'll reiterate, I wouldn't recommend anybody do what I do. I'm just saying, you know, this works for me, but it is kind of it still is. I feel like when I bring it up publicly that I'm not 100% comfortable talking about it, but I will and I do, and I feel as though I must, and I must for me, nobody else.
I don't know.
It's, you know, I think the true path to happiness is, or contentment, or to just not be suicidal, I suppose, is meditation, breath work, healthy eating and exercise.
Mm.
But I always remember being told this, and I always remember thinking, I can't get out of fucking bed.
And now you want me to do all this shit?
Yeah, it's like, you know, the amount of anything that I'm doing today is stopping after I've opened my eyes. After I've opened my eyes, that's enough humaning for me. So I don't know how you become somebody that has the energy and the wherewithal and the discipline to rise yourself to a place where you can do breath work, meditation, exercise, when, I don't know.
Do you think that is something, though, that kind of almost does take quite a period of time? It's like there isn't going to be a magic tablet. Yes, there are tablets that are going to help kind of correct sort of imbalance, and it, you know, that's a good starting place. But then there are actually lots of other things you can gradually put into your life that help.
I'm 48, and when I was 19, I was in a dreadful place.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got sober eventually. 18 months into sobriety, I felt worse than I did when I was using. And the way I look at it now is, I haven't got the fucking time. I haven't. You know, I'm 48. What do I get? If I'm really lucky, 23, 24 great years.
Yeah.
You know, I walked through the horizon. I got to that place where when I'm da-da-da, I will be da-da-da. Mm. Well, I wasn't da-da-da. You know, I haven't got the fucking time to trust the process.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think mental health is such a... We often, when we talk about mental health, talk about negative mental health, don't we? But actually what you're saying now is, I feel like my mental health is good because I need it to be, because I haven't got time to trust that process anymore. And I think it's really interesting that 18 months after you got sober, you felt worse than you did. My husband is an ex-drug addict, did NA, has been clean for 6 years. And I think I noticed that in him too, because I think you're, for the first time in your life, you're starting to deal with those feelings that drugs and alcohol numbed, right? And that's what a lot of users talk about. They couldn't sit with real life. They couldn't sit with what had happened to them or things that had gone on in their life. They couldn't sit with it. And that was Matthew. He couldn't sit with real life. And the amount of NA meetings I sat in where people said, I couldn't do life. So I took this stuff and it numbed those feelings and it got me through and it kept me going. So when I stopped it, all that life stuff came back and I had to learn how to deal with it in the here and now. And when you don't have drugs and alcohol, when you take that away, there's that deep sense, isn't there, of, oh, shit. I'll never forget one guy in an NA meeting saying, I've realised in the last 90 days not using drugs, this is what normal people feel like and I fucking hate it.
I don't think normal people do feel like that. If there's anything such, if there's anything that is normal people,
normal.
I don't think they do feel like that because if they did feel like that, they kill themselves.
Mm. God.
You know, and yeah, it's not just the inability to deal with life on life's terms. It's something's happened in your chemistry. Due to DNA, due to childhood trauma, due to genetics, that's made you what you are, and you are vulnerable to your own wiring. Mm. You know, it's not a deficiency. You're not deficient as a person against the world.
Yeah.
Your inner workings make it impossible. You know, like I've noticed
that.
That is
so profound.
I've noticed that, you know, I haven't had a drink for 22 years. I haven't had cocaine for nearly a couple of decades.
Wow.
I haven't had, you know, anything bad really for a long, long time. I've noticed the one thing that I cannot, and I really struggle with it, is sugar.
Really?
Sugar has been the most powerful drug in my life and was the first drug that I abused. You know, and I find that fascinating in itself, you know, that there is something. But mind you, you know, I suppose it's understandable because when I drink, bad things happen and I'm going to die. Mm. When I take cocaine, I come off cocaine and I visit hell. Mm. I don't want to be in hell. If you eat a donut, you go to bed.
Perfect.
Do you know what I mean?
Perfect.
So how are you, you know, is like, you know, I won't lose my wife and family because I had a pack of kettle chips.
And they're amazing.
Yeah, they're amazing. But thereby is the tale, you know, the tale is, you know, it has to be death or donuts.
Take the donuts.
I think we should call this episode Death or Donuts with
Death
Robbie
or
Williams.
Donuts. Yeah.
Can I just do one thing before we go? Rob, I don't know if you're aware, we do a little segment on our podcast called Urban Dictionary. I do a little jingle, do a little sing song. Anyway, what we do sometimes when we have guests on is I don't know if you've ever done this, you can Urban Dictionary your name.
Your own name.
Did you know this?
Oh,
right.
Okay.
So I thought... No. Less Urban Dictionary, Rob. Now, what you get is...
Right.
Not the full name.
Robbie.
No.
Robbie. Just Robbie.
Even that.
This is an Urban Dictionary of Robbie right now. What happens is you get a good one. You get a few good ones.
You get a really lovely one.
And then you get some really...
Start.
Whoa. Okay. So I've got you one of both.
It might get quite specific to me, though.
Well, let's just wait and see, Robbie, okay? So let's go with the good one first, okay? So this is
the top Urban
Dictionary.
This is
Urban Dictionary for Robbie.
Robbie.
Okay. A guy everyone is lucky to meet. He is one of a kind and a really great person in every way. He is the most amazing guy on earth. He's a fantastic listener and gives the best advice and motivation, which is, we've had that.
That is true.
This is because he is so inspiring and has a great heart. He has the best taste in everything from music to style. Look at that style going on. To cars.
Look at those pants.
Look at the pants. He will never fail to make you laugh. When you meet Robbie, your life will change and you will discover your destiny. A day without Robbie simply isn't a day.
Something bad's about to happen.
Yeah.
Something bad's about
now,
to happen.
The not so good one.
This is...
Right. Is actually quite funny.
Okay, go.
Okay, Robbie. Big dick and we'll eat you out like an all-you-can-eat Chinese buffet. Fancy.
Oh, my God.
An all-you-can-eat Chinese buffet? This is a little blurb. Rose, Robbie's dick is massive. I had to use 5 hands to handle it. So,
oh my God, I don't.
So there we go. That version of Robbie is big dick and will eat you out like an all-you-can-eat Chinese buffet.
I think the second Robbie is Robbie Fowler.
Yeah. Definitely. The first one
definitely
is you.
Robbie Fowler.
Well, listen, you know, I tell you a story about, you know.
A Chinese buffet?
No. I don't know. This just, you know, the quite specific nature of, you know, Robbie, you know, and my name being, you know, Robbie in the UK. I was years ago. I ventured into the howlhole that's the comment section in the Daily Mail.
Oh, God.
Oh, God,
and I was just
that?
Like, oh, my God, I am the worst person to ever inhabit the world, right?
Oh, my God.
And I was like, hang on, how do I dig my way out of this cesspit that I've fallen into? And I was like, I know. I'll think about somebody or some people the most authentic salt of the earth people I know in the industry. Mm-hmm. And if they then have bad comments written about them, it's just people.
Yes.
It's just people.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So I was like, you know, who I think are the most authentic salt of the earth people in the industry is Ant and Dec.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes. Yep.
And I went and read their comments. First one was like awful. And second one said, I hate these almost as much as I hate that cunt, Robbie Williams.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. That is hilarious.
I couldn't escape bad comments about me, even under other people's bad comments.
Bloody hell.
What a shitter. That is a shitter. Mm.
Hey, listen, I've had a very profound chat with you
tonight. Oh, God, Rob.
Thank you.
And it's...
We've just loved it so much. We can't thank you enough for giving up over an hour of your time.
Pleasure. Thank you for helping me, very beautiful souls, and you've given a safe space for me to talk what's in my mind and me to find out more about me. And it would seem that there is progress happening because... When you are just with your own thoughts, you know, you don't get to listen so clearly to yourself. But you've asked the right questions for me to go, there's movement, there's
amazing
maturity, and there's, you know, there's some kind of peace.
Well, thank you so much, Robbie.
I think we both want to say, Ange, to Rob, we have loved having you on. Thank you so much for giving up your time. We know how busy you are, and
yeah, it's been special. I've really enjoyed it.
Absolutely loved having you with us, so
thank you so much. Honestly, you'll never know how much this means to us, so thank
honestly,
you very much.
Yeah,
thank you.
Pleasure.
We do appreciate
absolute
it
pleasure.
And the 10 people that listen.
Well, there's 11 now. I'll be listening to this one.
Oh yes, we'll have 11.
There we go. That one in the bag. Thank you, Mr. Robbie. That's the only really Scottish word I can say.
Robbie. Yeah. Well, we hope you enjoyed it
really
as much as we did. And thank you. Robbie's told me he is going to listen.
Okay.
Rob has told me that. So
let's hope he enjoys
Rob
it too.
Again.
And then let's hope he becomes a regular listener.
Wow. Let's also hope he didn't switch off halfway through and didn't get to this outro.
Probably that's what will happen, isn't it? Yeah. Or he'll just skip to all his bits. You know, skip to his bits.
Yes.
Not interested in listening to those two. I just want to hear me.
Yeah.
Let's just carry on.
Yeah,
brilliant. They're finished.
Yeah. But remember, if you're new around here, we'd love you to continue to listen to Finding the Funny. You can find our whole back catalogue wherever you get your podcasts. We record once a week. Episodes go out every Wednesday, 6 a.m. If you found us because of Rob, we would love you to stick around. There's loads of places that you can get in touch with Ange and I. You can find us both on Instagram. I'm at Ruth Corden. She's at Ange Corden.
And you can find the podcast on Facebook, Instagram and TikTok. Just search Finding the Funny Podcast.
Finally, you can always send us an email. It's findingthefunnypodcast@gmail.com. But what a great episode. And Andrew and I will be back, just us two, with Rossi, regular episode next week, helping you to find more of the funny.